This is Mitch, and we're back on another beautiful Tuesday evening. Hey, somebody press star 2 so I can know you got me. Can you press star 2, Dave? There we go. All right. I see everybody's hand up, so I know you can hear me, so we'll get started here. I'm going to lower all the hands now, and then if you have a real question or comment, we'll start over here. So let me lower the hands. All right. Got a clean slate. We're actually doing very well at my end of town here. We contracted to buy 25 houses in January. I think we've taken about 14 of them down. The rest of them are, I don't know, in the title work process or getting funding or people moving out or whatever. But it's been one of my best months in my career ever. 25 houses in the month of January. We also had a goal to create 30 notes in the first quarter, and we created 27 notes in January. So everything's kind of ahead of schedule. It's a weird time. Crazy times. Everything sounds bad on the news and everything, and then we keep applying ourselves and keep ignoring all the negative crap, and we're doing quite well. So I got a hand up. So I got last four digits of the phone number, 1975.
Hey, Nick, this is Jay in Charlotte. How are you?
Jay, I almost said that. I'm getting closer to figuring it out.
We're gonna get it one of these times. So all right, here's I guess it's a cool scenario situation, but need you some help in your opinion. Was contacted by someone else in the note space who was contacted by a probate attorney or someone settling an estate. And I guess this gentleman had a seller finance promissory note, that's got 5+ years of on-time payments done on it. And then 2 contract for deeds. And I mean, as far as discounting and valuing the promissory note and stuff, that's pretty straightforward. But with the contract for a deed, that's a little hairier, right? It's not as simple as a transfer in the beneficial rights of a promissory note.
Well, no, they're going to have to transfer the deed to the title to you. You know what I mean? Because the deed, when you do a contract for deed, the deed remains in the owner, in the seller's name until the seller finance buyer pays them off, right? So the deed
Correct.
Is still the name of the estate. So they're going to have to transfer the deed. So, I mean, to the best of my knowledge, that's how I see it. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I guess where I don't know a whole lot of stuff about, dealing with, these items in probate or out of probate and who signs off. Is it the trustee that signs off on behalf of the dead seller, or what the deal is?
Well, it's the executor of the estate is the one that's going to be calling all the shots. So
okay.
Whoever the executor is will have to transfer it. I definitely wouldn't do this. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I wouldn't do this without the help of a lawyer. In the state where they're being done. You might want to review how those contract for deeds were done to make sure that they're tight enough and that they're conform with the laws at the time that he made them. Because, if he did those things 5 years ago, and 5 years ago you needed to have an RMLO and he didn't have one, I mean, I don't know where that puts you if they ever don't pay.
Yeah.
But I'm going to assume it puts you in the position of whoever sold you the note, whatever position they were in, because I think, you'll be taking it subject to their paperwork and their actions, is my instinct. So I definitely want to know if they conformed. If they didn't conform, it doesn't mean that you don't want to buy them, but you just can't get in a lawsuit with those people, you know. And it could be great fodder. I mean, if they didn't conform, you could point out all these hazardous things in the future or potential hazardous things, and you could drive the price of this note way the hell down. Unless they're going to try to sell it to some dummy who doesn't know this stuff, they might have to take whatever you want to offer them, you know what I mean, or more or less, you know?
Yeah, so I'm looking at that as saying I'm buying the note at the discount I want to pay the note at, and if they want to throw those two contract for deeds in there for free to simply close the estate and or settle the estate, I'll do that, but I'm not paying for those things.
Well, I mean, I don't know that that's exactly – I mean, that's, you can't get hurt looking at it like that, but you also maybe leaving a couple of good deals on the table. You could present that or you could have that attitude, but I'd still talk to my attorney and say, what's the pros and cons of buying this? You know, tell me where I can get hurt. If he says you really can't get hurt, then, you know, you can still hold that line – and try to tell them that a contract for deed is not worth anything, but you might want to come up with some amount of money for them. I mean, even if it's laughable.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And that's more or less what I would do. It wouldn't be for free or nothing. I mean, I was just kind of using that as an example of my stance on that.
Yeah. But where are these notes? What state?
South Carolina.
South Carolina has a judicial foreclosure. All three of them are in South Carolina?
Actually, in South Carolina, it's either – I thought it was either one. If it's written into the note as non-judicial, then it is. And if it's written in there as judicial, then it is judicial.
Okay, so have you looked at them to see how they're written?
No, I haven't even got – I have not. This call came in an hour or two ago, and –
okay. I also want you to look for some triggers.
Okay.
If in some states it's non-judicial until they go 5 years, you know, 5 years into the note, or until they pay 20% of the principal down, and then, you know what, it goes judicial. You know, look for the trigger. Is there a trigger in this one? Like if the note's matured to a certain level, and then you got to foreclose. I know in Ohio, like they have that, like it's. You know, for the first 5 years on a contract for deed, it's just an eviction. But after 5 years, it's a foreclosure.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll look for that. Yeah, we'll comb through those documents and see what's going on there.
The other way you could hedge your bet is you could find a note buyer and see what they'll pay you. And you, if it's too risky for you, you could just buy them at $30,000 and sell them to the note buyer at $40,000.
Yeah.
Like pass them through, you know?
Okay.
You know, instead of just walking away, see if you can find someone that doesn't care that they're contract for deeds.
Right.
And try to make yourself a spread. It's just like a host, you know, assign, you know, as soon as you get it, just assign it to them or sign it over to them. And make some money in the middle.
Right. Yep.
It might tell you, you know, if you shop around to people that buy contracts for deeds in South Carolina, you might find out what the normal going rate is, and you might get more comfort. You might even be able to talk to them about, you know, when you show them the contract, they say, well, this one has problems. They might point out the problems to you because they're professional contract for deed buyers and trying to get
right.
You down on your price. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Okay. That's a good idea. I like it.
Before I did that, I would get an option to buy them for 10 or 15 days so I wasn't shopping around to people I didn't know. And, of course, I'm going to have to divulge the information, and they might want to go around me. So I might want to get some kind of document that ties it up for 10 or 15 days while you're doing your due diligence before you start asking strangers what they think of this note. Because they're going to ask you, well, what's your position on this note? How are you selling it? Because you're nowhere on here. You could say, I have an option, you know.
Right.
Well, that would deter them from just going to try to deal direct. I don't know how they would do that or how they'd find the executor, but you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do understand.
Okay.
Okay.
Good question. Never been asked this stuff before, but, you know.
Well, I appreciate the help.
Anything else, Jay?
That's it.
All right, man. I appreciate you.
All right. Thank you.
Let's see. I got someone with the last four digits of their phone number, 6536. Who am I speaking with?
Mitch, this is Tim the Land Guy.
Tim the Land Guy. How you doing, Tim?
Doing well. I sent out some bigger mailers than I usually do because I'm just trying to not be so afraid, and I got some decent-sized fish on the hook for the land space anyways.
So you said bigger size. What do you mean? More mailings or higher price properties?
Higher price points. So in December, my highest purchase ever was $94,000, which is actually the my problem property, which I'm still working on. No news on that one yet.
Okay.
And now this week I'm going to buy one that's in Arizona for $115,000. I put out an offer on one for almost $200,000, and then I have another offer on a four package in Arizona for $450,000. So.
Okay, so here's my gut instinct, real quick, is if these are lots that have regulations and you have to build a certain size house and all this stuff, or they're gated communities, or I don't know, I'd be kind of careful of loading up, because if the economy turns, house building will stop, and it's hard to make money off these raw pieces of land, and you have these big investments in them.
That is definitely on my mind. Totally. I'm figuring I have about 6 months to a year of pretty solid safety to see what happens with the Fed this year. And then beyond that, I can't see any more in the future than that.
Well, you know your comfort level, but, you know, you bite off one or two or maybe however many you think you can handle if it all goes to shit. But I wouldn't bite off like 20 if you could only handle four, because if it goes to shit, you'll be sunk.
Absolutely. And so part of that, too, I'm trying to sometimes have agents check out some properties before I buy them, but I am slightly hesitant in that, in the agents potentially going around. I don't know if you ever deal with this or ever have thought about how to, you know, meet an agent, like you have them sign an NDA or non-soliciting, like have you ever experienced
it's
that?
Just what we talked about with Jay. Get an option. You know, when you write the contract, in the state of Texas, we have a paragraph for earnest money, and then we got a paragraph for option fee. The option fee is non-refundable, but it gives you the right to walk away without being sued for specific performance, right? Basically, it says, I'm going to give you, $3,000 earnest money, and I'm going to give you $1,000 option fee for the $4,000, you know. But if I walk away, you just keep my $1,000, but you can't come after me.
Mm-hmm.
So look at your contract to see if you have an option choice in your regular contracts. If not, you could get with an attorney or put a paragraph in or get yourself your own option agreement and just make them sign that before you start shopping around, because that's a real problem.
Oh yeah, definitely. I have to be very sneaky right now.
Well, I wouldn't call it sneaky, but I'd say you got to be savvy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely with that. And then another question here. I know you do cold calling, probably texting, probably everything, but do you do direct mail for lead generation currently?
Yes, we do direct mail to we focus a lot on the property tax delinquency list.
Okay.
And then, you know, if you can only mail 1,000 a month, then you take, you know, the 10,000 that you have and you try to mail it to the 1,000 that have the most equity or the most potential, the oldest loans. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so do you mail the same people over and over again? And if you do, do you do different letters? Do you go through a sequence of letters?
I have to check with my office to see exactly what they do because it changes all the time. But
okay.
One of the things I know that we were doing was we were just skip tracing, you know, the top 50% of the list and having my VAs call them. And then if they were lukewarm, we talked to them. If they didn't want to sell, then we started the mailing. So we were mailing to someone that we had a conversation with that obviously was thinking about selling, but they didn't sell today. And then they go into our CRM, you know, our follow-up system.
Yeah.
And just kind of cut out. I mean, because what are you doing? You're mailing out that list and you're waiting for them to take some action. I would rather I take the action and call them and try to get a hold of them and get them on the line and then spend my dollars on people that were relatively interested, you know, in my longer term touch program.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What state are you in?
I'm in Washington, but I'm, you know, doing deals in 6 different states.
You were doing any in Texas?
I've done one in Texas. Texas is a non-disclosure state, and Texas is, I'm sure you'll agree, it's kind of like its own country. So there's a lot of different stuff in Texas. So I went in there, and then I left, and I'm in other states now that are closer to Washington style, Oregon, California, Ohio, Colorado.
Okay, well, Texas has some of the strongest foreclosure laws and really – you know, they're advocates more for the owner than they are for the consumer at this point still. But, I mean, you got more rights as an owner than in a lot of places. But the reason why I was asking, and you're not probably – this won't apply to you, but there's some other people on the call. I just finished writing a book called How to Stop Property Foreclosure in an Hour or Less. It's for the state of Texas. And when I find someone who's pretty interested or that wants to sell but haven't committed, I send them a free book. You know, like, do you want to keep your house? If you want to keep your house, let me help you keep your house. Let me send you this book. And well, the first thing the book says is, you know, time is of the essence. You need to find out where you are. If you don't know where you are or you know, how long you have left on the clock and you don't know where to go get it, why don't you just call me? And I'll help find out this stuff, you know. And then they call you, you say, well, I need a copy of your mortgage. I need all this stuff. And let me call and find out where you are in the process. Well, I'm going to help them save their house if I can. But nine times out of ten, it always comes down to, well, you owe $15,000. Do you have a car you can sell? Do you have a lot I can buy from you? What do you got that you can liquidate? And nine times out of ten, it comes down to you got to come up with the money. And they can't. So then I'm in good graces with them because I've tried to help them. I already know everything about the property. I can say, well, you need to sell this before the clock strikes midnight or you're going to be out everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can still get some money from this, but don't walk away with nothing. And then I try to buy it like that. Now, I haven't done this yet because I just got my box full of books delivered. But anyways, that's one thing I was doing, and maybe you don't have a book, but maybe you could offer to help. You know what I mean? If you want to keep your house in your property foreclosure, I'm an expert at helping people keep their house. And then you run all the traps, and nine times out of ten, they can't perform. Mm-hmm. But you're the only person that ever told them, tried to help them keep their house.
That's a great idea. That was a good one.
No, you could run ads or send out mailers to these tax delinquent people that says, you know, if you want to try to save your house and you want to keep your property and you just don't know what to do, I'm an expert at the ins and outs of property tax foreclosure in the state of X. Why don't you call me and let me see if I can help you keep your house? And then you earnestly try to talk to them and figure out anything you can. You know, do you just need more? You know, just ask them 20 questions and try to figure out if there's any way that, you know, that you can see for them to get out. And most of the time they can't.
Yeah.
You might end up with another property that they could liquidate and save their house, and then you get to buy that one.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Good idea on that. Also, I'm going to be starting reading your book, The Art of Private Lending here probably next week. So looking forward to that.
Good for you. So just so you know, I didn't write that book to make money off of book sales. Hopefully it'll make back enough money for what time and effort I spent on it. But I wrote that book to give to people that have money that are thinking about self-directing their IRAs or that might potentially loan me money. And in the book, you'll notice I'm teaching them how to be a private lender and make 14, 16, 18%. You know, like I'm teaching them how to go do it on their own. And then you go through it and on purpose, but not really on purpose, it's the truth. You know, to go loan your own money and become a hard money lender for your own money, you're going to have to learn a lot of skills. And so it kind of overwhelms them. And then about, you know, a third of the way in, it starts saying, but if you want to keep playing golf and you want to remain retired and you really don't want another, or you just don't want another job and have to do all this, you can loan it to professionals like me that will adhere to all these rules that I just told you you have to do and all these safety things and all these safety features. But you'll just get a check in the mail. It'll be very passive. And so that's what I'm hoping to accomplish. I'm out there teaching people how to loan their money and make 12, 14, 16, 18%, you know, whatever you can make in your state legally. Mm-hmm. But then the caveat is like, and if you don't want to do all this shit, just get on a consultation with me and I'll borrow your money at 8 or 9%. I'll give you the same first liens I told you need to have. We'll live by the same underwriting guidelines that I told you need to have. But I've been doing it for 27 years and I'll just send you a check. You won't make 14%, but you might make 8%. Or 9 or 10, you know, whatever number you want to pick. You know, you won't make 12 or 14%, but you can make 8 or 9.
And yeah, that's really a smart move on that. And speaking of private lending, I'm doing my first, I'm hypothecating a few notes here in about 2 weeks to get some acquisition funds. So I'm excited about that.
Okay, so let me tell you, this is top secret information here, so everyone's sworn to secrecy, okay?
Right.
I licensed that book from Max Keller, and I went through it, and I changed anything I wanted to in it, and I made it my own, put my own name on it. You know, I licensed it, put Mike and I's name on it, and I didn't have to write a book. I paid $5,000 for that. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And then I personalized it. I put my own pictures in it. I put my own little stories wherever I wanted to. And I can't sell it on Amazon because, you know what I mean? It's not an original book. There's probably, you know, they're all over the place. But under different names, you know, they had book covers that you could choose from that they already had made up. And I said, no, I want my book covers to look like all my other books. And they said, no problem. And I went to 99 Designs and ran a contest for a book cover that looked, you know, I showed them examples of my other book and they used all the same colors. And so it looks like it fits right in my library. If I don't tell you, there's a 99.9% chance you'll never know that I didn't write that book myself, but I don't care for the world to know that, but I'll tell y'all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you could tell a little bit, there's no country songs in it. So, you know.
Say that again?
There's no country songs in it, Mitch.
Yeah, that's the most embarrassing part, man. Those songs were from 20 years ago, and I've become a much better writer, and now I'm looking at my songs going, holy shit, this sucks.
that's every artist every time. I have one little win to share, and then I'm good if you're good, Mitch.
Yeah, let's do it.
So, I don't know if I said this last week, but it wasn't done officially. I sold a nice little property in Ohio. It is my single largest profit on a deal. Bought for 18 or about 19,000 bucks, and then got really lucky on this one. I ended up selling it for 70, and I owned the property for about 33 days.
Wow. A cool 50 grand, give or take a few.
Basically, yeah. A very nice little one there, and, you know. Keeping on, keeping on.
And how did you find that house?
I found, well, a piece of land, but I found it through direct mail. So I just mail off. I do about, right now about 10,000 pieces of mail a month is what I'm at right now.
Yeah, so I don't know if I told you, but, you know, my acquisition managers did very well this last year. They've been with me 3, 4, maybe 6 years at the most out of the three of them. You know, the most one guy made was about 220, and the least one guy made was 150, but he was 3 months down with COVID. So they made very good money, so we called them in and said, you know, you guys are going to have to start getting, you know, there's three of y'all. Each one of y'all need to have a VA or be responsible for a VA. I could see that they were getting wore out on the cold calls. You know, 3 or 4 years of calling, you know, first 100 people a day and then, you know, 300 people a week. And then now it's down to, they're telling me they're calling 200 a week, but I bet you it's only 100. And you can just see them burning out. So how it ended up is they decided to co-op three, and they were just going to put the leads on a rotating schedule, you know. You know, it just rotated between the three of them. You know, you get one, the next one's his, the next one's his, and then it starts over again. And they did a – they just trained the VAs this month, but in January. But in January, those VAs were responsible for digging up 6 properties that we bought that probably would not have gotten bought. And you don't know those other – they were calling 800 people a day between the three of them. And you don't know how many of those 800 will show up next month or the month after, or, you know what I mean, 6 months from now because of those contacts. Because we also took the ones that were lukewarm, and like we said, we started putting them in the touch system. You know, a mail out, you know, maybe a text now and then, and then the VA's got to call them back every month, you know, so they keep having things they got to go back to follow up on. So it's not like you have to keep creating an original list all the time and run out of numbers, you know, we give them another list next month and another list next month, but then they got 1600 people they got to call back that they've already talked to that didn't sell.
That's awesome.
So I just needed to point that out. And they were, you know, the acquisition managers, the two older ones understood exactly and were willing. But the younger one, who made the most money, by the way, 220 grand this year, he's like, I really don't know if I want to pay for these guys. And we said, you don't have a choice. You know, we're going to try it. And then from that conversation said, we're going to try it for a quarter and we'll revisit it. If it's not working, we won't want to do it anymore. But you're going to find out, we think, that it was really dumb that you didn't have one even 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So already in the first month, it's like, okay, you know, this is working. And it's working until it doesn't. But probably the main thing is one of the three acquisition guys is experienced in running a phone room, you know, phone sale room. And he volunteered to train the three, and he's taken $500 for every consummated deal for training them. And so I just thought you might find it interesting how we were setting that up.
Yeah, I definitely do. And currently I'm doing no cold calling mail only, but yeah, that could be something I add in eventually. So many different ways to market.
You are getting return mail, right?
Very rarely, because they check it against a lot of different databases as it goes out. My mailhouse does, and any sort of forwarding address.
Well, I mean, I like the return mails, because if my piece didn't get to them, no one's piece is getting to them. You know, they're out there, they're an island, and when I finally find them through Skip Trace, I have no competition. There's not 1,000 other letters sitting on their desk. No one's been calling them. So I would think about loosening that up so that you did send out to property owners that are not where they're supposed to be, and then you put that into the Skip Trace bucket, and you send that over to the Skip Trace guys, and they send you back you know, where they are and their phone number. And now you got a virgin lead.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how you readjust that to get some more return mail. But, like, when we mail out, we do 10,000 mailings. You know, if the phone rings because of the mailing, that's great. What we're really interested in is the 400 more or less returns that we're going to get. Because then we take those returns, you know, they went to where they were supposed to go and the guy wasn't there. Now we're going to work. Now we're going to go find them.
So oh, that's a lot, 400%.
Yeah, I'm just saying. And plus, we mailed out 10,000, but we don't have to mail out 10,000 next month until we exhaust these 400. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that. Well, hey. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Well, the 400 go on a spreadsheet. They get divided up among the three acquisition guys. And then you keep track of them. I mean, you like actually when you get 400 back, you start writing, you know, you get the stack of them. You number them all, one to 400. And you put them on a spreadsheet. And it's like, all right, you get 125 of these, you know, 130 of these. And you get 130, and the other guy gets 130, and then they got to report back, like, where are you at with your 130? Have you called them all? Which ones can you get a hold of? Which ones can you still not find? When they give up on finding them, do we just ask them, are you giving up on these four or these five? And they go, yeah, me and Mike take them ourselves, and we hire a super expensive skip trace guy who almost always finds them. And we take those five that no one wanted to put the effort in to find, and we spend a little extra money, and we get a hold of those five ourselves.
And I'm assuming that those are some pretty rock star deals once you go down that far of the path.
They make the most money of all the deals we do on average, because no one's been calling them or hounding them or making offers to them or anything. And some of them we even had to find in other countries. We had one we made $90,000 off of, $93,000 off of, that he was either this guy in one country that spoke one language, or he's in this other guy in another country that spoke this other language. And we found him on Facebook. And so we got someone to translate in both languages and said, are you the guy that, have you ever lived in San Antonio? Do you know anything about this house on this street? And one guy called back. He drove to the embassy and signed papers, and we made a deal, and it was money from heaven. He didn't even know he owned the house.
That's awesome.
So just my two cents on that.
I know. I like it. Yeah. It's more ideas of how to get in touch with people. I mean, that's again, your book of, what is 100 ways how to find houses? I forget exactly the number you have in there, but you had a lot in there.
Yeah, 200 plus ways to find bargain properties. I put 215 in there because I knew someone would count, and I want them to know I over-delivered. Because, you know, if I only put 198, someone's going to call me up and say, you said 200, but there's only 198. You know that was going to happen, right?
Yes, that it was, 100%.
Yeah, so... I'm interested to know who's running that list to say you don't want this one because it there's no one there yet. There's no one there still. I'd like to find out where that cutoff is, and I'd like to open up that valve. You might even ask them, can I have all the ones where nobody's where they're supposed to be? The ones that are getting return mail, I want those addresses. And then you send them all over to the skip trace person. I would want every single one of them.
Interesting. Yeah, I could post on that in some groups too, because I'm sure other people have that.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? Hey, I'm interested in all your return postcards and all your return letters. You know, I'll buy them from you for $1 a piece.
Yeah. That is a good idea right there. I think I got my actionable idea here, Mitch. Thank you so much.
All right, man. That's why I get paid the big bucks. I'm laughing. All right, my friend. Yeah. Anything else?
All right, Mitch. Well, that's it for now.
All right.
Thank you.
Dave, what's going on?
Hi, Mitch. Well, we've got a fire burning in a fertilizer factory with 600 tons of the stuff that blew up in Texas not too long ago.
Well, I just run over there and get you a big whiff of that.
Don't laugh at that. I've got two owner-financed houses within the radius, explosion radius. I'm hoping that thing doesn't blow.
Oh, man. That's not good.
Yeah. Well, I have hopes that I can get some parameters from you. I've been searching for some land that might be good for either big rig parking or mini storage, and I don't have cost parameters. I've come up with about 10 acres that has a few hundred feet on a really good road. Very close to the freeway, and then most of the 10 acres is kind of tucked back from that. But it looks like it could be, the right amount of space and at the right place. But I don't have any cost parameters as far as how much is worth paying for an acre of good land for either a mini storage or the truck parking. And I'm just hoping you might help me with that.
You know, I know it in the times that I buy my land, you know, that I do this on, but then it quickly escapes my mind because it depends on what the rents are for the what they're getting for rents in the area. You know, rents in town are much higher than rents out rural, you know what I mean? And also...
Yes.
How much your building costs are, and building costs have been changing so much. I mean, if you got to pay more for materials and the rent's not really going up, then you got to pay less for the land. So the number is right now, and I don't know the right now number, especially not where you're at. You know what I mean? So I wish I could help you more, but I figure out what the average cost is to build, you know, what the average per square foot cost is to build, you know, 100 unit complex or whatever, you know, so you got some kind. I wouldn't want to figure out how to build, you know, one 10 by 10 because you don't get any economy of scale. You know, you're going to build more than one a rental unit. So just pick a number like 100. It's pretty easy to figure out, you know, if 100 is this much, then 150 is that much and 200 is double. And you know what I mean? And then when you know about what it costs to build one, that's concrete site work is the one thing you got to throw out, because site work is the most elusive number in the whole thing. I mean, we can figure out how much metal is. We can figure out how much the beams are, the nuts and the bolts and the doors. No one can ever really tell you what the site work's going to be. They can estimate it. They can go out there and shoot it and see, you know, where they have to cut down on one side and raise up on the other side or whatever they have to do. It's still an elusive number because they don't know if they're going to hit rock, if they got clay. You know what I mean? Like here, they don't know when they're going to hit rock. And, you know, you could be real easy sailing for 2 feet, and then you could like, oh, crap, I just hit the caliche rock. So no one can really tell you what it's going to be. They can give you – so that's the hardest number is the site work. So I take the site work to the side and put it off as a number by itself somewhere on the side to be dealt with later. But I'd figure out – what it costs to build 100 units per square foot, and then I'd figure out my cost of land and what it's going to cost me to borrow the money, or, you know, if I'm not going to borrow the money, whatever, what my cost is going to be for that. And I just start seeing, and then you got to find out what the rents are in the area, and you start plugging in numbers to a hypothetical storage facility and just see if you think it makes money. Like, don't...
Yes.
Overcomplicated. Now, if you go to the, like in San Antonio, or in Texas, we have Texas Self-Storage Association, or TSSA, or whatever, and you can become a part of that group. And they got, you know, people that'll do the demographics to tell you if the area can afford any more units and what size units you need to build and what the average income within a five-mile radius is and how much that five-mile radius spends per person, you know, and those demographic reports cost between $4,000 and $6,000, and they can tell you, those guys can really tell you a whole lot about what you're trying to do. I'd rather spend $4,000 or $5,000 and walk away than to spend $500,000 or whatever and build the wrong thing in the wrong place.
Sure.
But a lot of times they'll say, you know, you can't do storages here. Then you back up and say, okay, well, can I do covered parking? You know, because we just did this. They came back and told us we spent $6,000 on one of these reports, and man, they are detailed. They know everybody, prices, occupancies, income, average income household, how much every person within that population is using in storage space. Like, you know, I think it was every person needed a half a square foot of storage space. That's what that place could stand. And then they went out and figured out how much storage space was out there against the population, and they tell you if there's any availability room for you to carve out a piece. They told us, absolutely do not build mini storages. It's overbuilt. They have vacancies. There's, you know, an abundance of storage facilities sitting vacant. So we went back and said, well, what about covered parking or RV parking? They went back and came back within like 24 hours and said, man, there isn't a place around you for 7 miles. This is a great thing to do. So we switched from self-storage to RV covered parking.
Huh.
So I guess what I'm saying is, just because they shoot you down on the storage, you know, the self-storage is a little walk-up box where you roll up the door and drive up to it and empty your truck and then leave. There's other kinds of storage. You know, after that, it was going to be, well, how many open parking spaces are there where you just fence it and put a gate and a mobile home at the front so someone can live there and it looks like security, and people just park out in the, under the stars. You know, that was the next thing, you know, or semi-truck parking, or, you know, there's more than just one kind of storage, you know what I mean? Boat storages,
yes.
You know? So, and then they would tell you exactly what you'd get for what everyone's getting for a 15 by 40 with concrete, with electric, you know, a 15 by 40 with dirt floors, no electric. I mean, they very concise, you know, they're worth their money. I don't like paying it, but they're worth their money. That, if that makes any sense.
Is there a similar study service that you've heard of for the truck parking? Because that's really, you know, what I'm seeing near.
I imagine these guys that might even be opening up those avenues. I mean, the guy that I had, let me see if I have this guy's name. He's national. He does these reports all over the country.
Yes.
I don't even know what we call them, storage. Well, I'm trying to find this guy here, but I don't know if I'll be able to find him. But you know, you can go to these metal building sales places. And they probably know what it costs per square foot to do this. At least you can know what the buildings cost and the doors, and then you can call some concrete guys and figure out what they charge. You know, you can piece it together. Donald Jones, storage feasibility. Are you ready?
Ready.
817-456-1000. 4658. Tell him that Mitch Steven and Mike Powell sent you. He might recognize Mike Powell before he recognized me because Mike dealt with him mostly.
Okay. Thank you.
But they're storage feasibility analysts is what I have here for their description. And but I tell you, this all sounds really complicated, but when I built my storages out here in Canyon Lake, you know, I was outside the city. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay. You know, I was outside the city limits. I mean, I was out here that, you know, there's no – Canyon Lake doesn't have an incorporation. It's not a city. It's just a bunch of land around a lake. We say we live in Canyon Lake, Texas, but there is no formal Canyon Lake, Texas. There's no incorporation. And I'm just buying land, and I'm getting some kind of storage architect to give me a preliminary drawing of the best use of the land. Now, without the demographic report, I can't tell you how many 10 by 10s and 10 by 20s and 10 by 30s I need. So I just kind of make it up. And then I start plugging in the rental numbers that, you know, from some people I called around the deal, around the lake, so I know what people are charging more or less. But if you have the demographic study, you don't have to make those calls. And if you go to people that are professional storage builders, that's all they do is build self-storages or storage buildings, they'll actually lay out your land with all your buildings and get the most use out of it for free in hopes that they get your business when you decide to hire a builder. They'll do it to get their hooks in you. Is that interesting?
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't ever know that. I was always with myself with a piece of paper and trying to do it. And then I decided, well, I'll go to, you know, my engineer friend who knows how to use CAD and everything, and he tries to lay it out. And then I found out these storage building companies, a lot of them, will do the layout for free for you. Now, if you don't tell them what sizes, they'll just draw the slab footprint without any specific unit sizes on them, but they'll show you how to lay your slabs out to get the most out of your property. They'll have to know the setbacks, of course, you know, so you have to give them a survey that has the setback dimensions, but then they'll sketch it all out for you and get your optimal use.
Yes.
You'd have to tell them if you wanted I want a single wide, you know, 15 by, you know, 16 by 70 mobile home on it, or I want a double wide, you know, 40 by whatever, you know, so they can figure that in too and leave you some room for a septic and, you know, whatever you need for that place, a carport or whatever. But, yeah, those are great helps. But what I was going to say is I did all this stuff with nobody, no architects, no demographic reports. You know, I did 1,300 doors before I started using these people. But I started looking at more expensive pieces of land and bigger facilities, and I didn't want to make that size mistake, you know. But I was doing what you were doing. And if you have like that 10 acres, you might just put a row right up front with some 10 by 20s and some 10 by 10s and some 10 by 15s and, you know, and then you could go in the back and you could build a row parallel to the front. You know, you build across the front, you build across the back, and those would be like covered parking. And then you start leasing and taking phone calls and you start asking people, you know, what do you want? And they start telling you, I need a 10 by 20, 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 and you're all out of 10 by 20s. You know, you build another row right behind the front row. You build the second row, you know, and then you fill up in the back with the covered parking. So you build another row. You're like working towards the middle, but you're letting your company tell you what to build. That's the great thing about storages is you don't have to build the whole complex at one time. If you can't afford it, you can just build the row as you need them.
Yes.
And that way you never overbuild. You'll lose some economy of scale, right? Because it's cheaper to build 280 units all at one time than it is to build them 50 at a time. You know what I'm saying? But you also get your unit mix way right because you have the public telling you what to build.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Well, I didn't really help you what you wanted, but I hope that was some kind of help.
Oh, it helped a lot. You know, with a few other things that you said in the past about the amount of you know, surface that you need, the depth and everything for the truck parking, that's you know, kind of go back through my notes and kind of try to put everything together. And
yeah, the other thing is you might just start out like taking, you know, I'm going to buy this land. I know how much it costs to build a row of storages. These storages do I have to buy and lease to break even? So at least it's not costing me anything. And that's where I would start.
Good point. Yeah. All right. Okay. Let me move to a second question, if I may. I just wondered, when you're helping a new private lender to create a self-directed 401k from their current whatever they've got, you know, they've got you're trying to move them into the position where they can loan you the money. What do you give them do you just turn them over to Tim Berry or someone what steps do you actually go through with them? Or does it depend on the person?
Well, you know, in all full disclosure, right, I'm in business with Tim Berry with TaxFreeFuture.com, right? So they just go to – you tell them to go to TaxFreeFuture.com. They can watch those little video vignettes where I'm interviewing Tim, and you're talking about all the great things you can do and, you know, very interesting. And we're talking about, you know, what it takes to roll one over. It's a non-taxable event. It's just a rollover. There's some qualifications for some of them, you know, and they just fill out that little micro form, and someone on my side will get a hold of them and talk to them. And then if they seem serious enough or ready to move, we'll get them an appointment with Tim, and Tim answers their very specific questions about their very specific circumstance, you know, and, if they decide to go ahead, then they pay $1,500 up front plus the cost of an LLC or a corporation, which will be the first thing that their new self-directed retirement fund will buy. It'll buy a corporation. That'll be the first thing it owns. And the reason why is that's how you get checkbook control. Because if your retirement plan buys a business has to have a checkbook in a bank account. And the business has to be able to write checks to do business. And so all of a sudden now you're not waiting on trustees to tell you if you can or you can't, or, you know, or they went on vacation and they can't get to you right now and then you lose your deal. You only got to lose one deal and you'll figure out why you want checkbook control. And you lose that deal because the trustees are hem-hawing around or they're not sure that, you know, they want to endorse whatever it is you're buying or you know, they're backlogged and they can't get to your file right now. And of course, we know you can't buy great deals in slow motion. So you got to hurry up and close this thing out of your IRA, and they take too long and you lose it. You only got to have that happen to you once. And then you'll go get one. Now, you can get retirement funds. You can get into a retirement fund for zero. There's no cost up front. And they're probably not going to let you buy a company. You know, they're just going to let you park money there, and you can't have a company with checkbook control in a bank account. And they're going to fee you to death on the back end every year. You know, there's a transaction fee. There's a service fee. And there's a, when you call for a balance or a payoff fee. And then there's even a fee for, you know, in some of these companies, what is the total of your retirement plan worth? Well, it's worth, you know, $1.5 million. Okay, well, there's a, you got to pay 2% of the value every year in addition to all those fees. I looked up and I had four accounts and I was paying $3,000 a year in four times four. I was paying $12,000 a year to have them. I would have much rather paid $1,500 one time and you know, through taxfreefuture.com, the annual maintenance fee is $225 fixed for the life of the account. So I was sending so many people to Tim that I just went in business with him, you know, because the other reason why I wanted to do it, quite frankly, and this is inside stuff, is if those people were talking to me and I sent them over to Tim, then when they did roll over, I could be privy to how much they had in their account. And then I could,
right,
because they're already my client, you know, or I might learn how much they have by talking to them and talking to them about the rollover. How much do you want to roll over? Do you have properties in it? Is it all cash or how much cash? You know, and they tell me, I say, wow, this guy's got a lot of money in there. I need to send him my private lending book and show him what he could do if he loaned his money out. So I talked to him about loaning, you know, he could loan his money out. And then at the end of the conversation, and by the way, if you ever want to do that, I'd like to throw my hat in the ring. I got, you know, I need private money and I got a good track record. I've got integrity that you can verify, you know. And so that's one of the reasons I started taxfreefuture.com is one, I was doing it so much. Two, I didn't like I was having to pay all these fees, and I called Tim, and he says, well, you don't have to pay those fees if you go with me. And then I just worked out a deal with him and said, you know, if I can turn this on and charge a little up front and promote for you, can I do it? And that's, he said, yes, you know. And I needed to make my fee that it made sense, you know, that you know, pay a little now one time and hardly anything for the rest of your life, or don't pay anything right now and just owe them every year for the rest of your life, you know, on much bigger annual fees. Ever growing. The bigger your account gets, the more transactions you do, the better you get, the more they're going to charge you till it gets absurd. I know people that were paying $12,000, $15,000 a year in fees. I said, I can stop that. Give me $1,500 plus whatever it costs to form your entity, and your fees will go to $225 for the rest of your life.
So for most of the people that you get in contact with who have their money in an IRA or whatever, you try to get them to convert right away to the self-directed?
Yeah, and I don't care. I mean, if they go with Tim or they don't go with Tim, just as long as they get it self-directed so they can loan me the money, I don't care where they go, really. You know, I'm not paying their annual fees. But, you know, in the name of giving them an option, I give them the choice. You know, there's many, many, many you can get into for free, and then they'll fee you to death if you're doing any kind of volume or you're moving in and out all the time or whatever. But you could pay a little bit now and not have to worry about that.
Or you could pay through the nose to a company like Equity Trust, not mentioning any names, Equity Trust, who then blows at least two deals because they couldn't get their paperwork done in time, and you lost two good deals. Not mentioning any names.
You just basically described my life story and how I got to TFF. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah,
you know, one of them was worth $30,000, and one of them was worth $50,000 to me. And I said, "That's enough of that bullshit." And I started doing research, trying to figure out how in the hell can I stop this. And the answer is checkbook control. Now I got to tell you, checkbook control is controversial. You got people that are against it, and people that say it's okay. Okay, so I'm just in all honesty, you know what I mean? But here's the other thing that's good about checkbook control. With, you know, you own an LLC. Well, in a traditional retirement plan, you can't buy antique cars or antique guitars or artwork. There's all these things you can't buy low and sell high. It's prohibited. But if you own a company, it can buy anything it wants to at a price and sell it for a profit because that's what the company does.
Right.
So all these prohibited transactions aren't prohibited anymore. Now, there's still arm's length. You can't deal with your dad or your son. You know, you can't deal linearly. That's still prohibited. A lot of people don't know that, but you can deal with your sideways. You can deal with your aunts and uncles and that stuff. You just can't deal linear, straight up and down. My son or my father or my grandfather, I can't deal linear. But I can go right or left to uncles and cousins. And, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Now, I got to preface all this by I'm not an attorney and I don't know what the hell I'm talking about, but this is my understanding, okay? You need to get your own attorney or get Tim to tell you. What I like about Tim is I call Tim up and go, you know, if it's anything outside of a normal deal that I already know that's okay, if it even has any kind of hair on it at all, I just call Tim and say, this is what I'm thinking about doing. And he goes, well, I don't think I'd do it like that. I know some people, and they do it this way. And it avoids a bunch of red flags.
Yes.
Now, you're not going to get that from a lot of other people. I mean, this guy can think. Most trustees of these things, they're in the business of no. Can I? No. Can I? You haven't even heard my sentence yet. No. You know, they don't even hear the finish, what you're trying to do, and they're telling you no. You know, Tim's like, talk to me. What do we got going? And he listens. And then 9 times out of 10, there's a way around it. I didn't think I could get a 401k because my daughter works for me, and you're only allowed to have, you know, in a solo 401k, a solo entrepreneur, you're only allowed to have, you can't have employees over 1,000 hours a year. Well, my daughter was clearly over 1,000. So I said, well, I really want a solo 401k, but my daughter's been my employee forever, and she works over 1,000 hours a year. And he goes, no, there's ways to do it. And I said, well, how do I do it? He says, she's your daughter, right? And I said, yeah. He says, well, make her 2% owner of the corporation, and now she's a paid employee. She's not a – I mean, she's a paid owner, not an employee. I said, oh. You know, but you're going to get that answer out of these other companies. You're never going to get that talk out of them. That's why I like Tim. But some people don't like Tim because the checkbook IRA has some arguments against it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I'm just telling you. Do I have one? Yes. Do I have three? Yes. So I heard the arguments, and I went with Tim. The other thing is if you do prohibitive transactions, Tim's been over 25 years in negotiating or fixing screw-ups. Or otherwise, how do you say this politically correct? Maybe just burying it. Maybe just putting so much distance between the red flag and the problem that it's never going to get noticed. I mean, you've already made the mistake. You can't undo it. So how do you get as far away from it as you can? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
You can't fix it, but there's things to do, you know, that'll and it's not illegal. I mean, he's never going to tell you to do anything illegal.
Right.
But that's the other reason why I like him. Is when I want to know how to do something, I go to someone who's going to think and apply all of his years and all of his knowledge to how I can do it, not how I can't do it.
Yes.
So did I scare you?
Not a bit. This is really, really good. A lot of reviews, some stuff I wasn't, I didn't pick up before, but I was having a meeting with someone this week who works for one of the major airlines. And I was basically trying to recruit her because it occurred to me that all of the people she works with at the major airlines, and she's been there for quite a while, that they probably have a 401k sitting around that they're making 2% or gambling in the stock market on, that they should be loaning that money to me.
Well, they're allowed to self-direct it. A lot of times, if you're employed there, you have to live by the company, whatever the company's investing in. But as soon as they quit or retire, they can roll it over and start to self-direct. I don't know that they can self-direct while they're still working for the airlines and the airlines is calling the shot. I don't know that. I don't think so. But you might ask them directly.
Yes, but they could still right. They might be able to. It might be something they could do when they retire, and there might be something they could do, while they're still doing that job that would work.
This is exactly the thing.
Would be nice.
You get them to get an appointment with Tim, a free consult, and he'll figure out what they can do and tell them. You know what I mean?
Right.
He'll say, well, let me see your plan or let me call your guy or whatever. You know what I mean? He'll figure out if they can or they can't. I hate to obligate what Tim can and can't do, but I'm saying he'll apply himself, and I wouldn't be surprised if he knows the answer already. He probably already knows whether American Airlines can roll over their 401k right now or they have to retire first.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. That's exactly what I was what I needed. I was looking for that kind of what's the next step here, and I see exactly what I need to do.
Okay, so let me just say to everyone on the call, I'm an owner of, I'm not an owner. I have a strong interest in taxfreefuture.com, but it's a great place to go. You don't really care where they go, but I'm just trying to send you someplace where someone will actually be creative and talk to people about what they can do, not what they can't do. And he's a good guy to talk to.
Amen to that.
All right, man. I appreciate
your
time.
Thanks so much. Okay. Good night.
Man, we got a lot of interesting stuff today, kind of out of the box questions or situations. I love it. I hope I'm doing a decent job of filling in here, but this is the world as I understand it, right or wrong. Seek your own legal advice and get your own attorneys, CPAs to confirm or discredit me, but that's the way I see it, and I could be wrong. So make sure you get your legal advice from a professional, licensed, whatever. All right, no hands up right now, so press star 2 to raise your hands if you don't have any more questions or comments. Okay, got a couple of hands up. Last four digits of the phone number are 6600. Who am I speaking with?
Hi, Mitch. This is Rick.
Hey, Rick. How
you
doing?
Good. How are you? So really interesting conversation. Really interesting conversation. So my question is, because that's what I heard about the check control, that it's more like a two-sided sword, that it can bite you if you don't do it right.
Yeah,
so
I believe I have the guy that knows how to do it right, and I'm trusting that he does after 25 years, and I chose to go with him, and so far in my career, it hasn't been a problem.
Okay, so my question is, what he will guide us to go through a corporation, by the corporation, and then do business under the corporation, but still, will you be writing the check?
Yeah, whoever's got the right to write checks for that company that he makes, you tell him who it is, And that's the person who wants to fix.
Okay.
And then you go get checks for that company.
But it will not be us writing the checks. It will be somebody
else. No, it'll be you. It'll be you.
Oh, really?
Or whoever you appoint in your household or whatever.
Okay. And the other question was, is because right now I do have my retail business, the jewelry store, and then I open an account with Equity Trust and the other one, I forgot the name, it's in Texas, in Houston area. You do a lot of Quest, I think.
Yeah, Quest IRA.
And I didn't put too, because I didn't have any IRAs or anything, so I just put $1,000 each in starting. So if I, and so instead of me going this route, if I go with this route, but I have a small budget, is that okay with the corporation route, or it has to be a big lump sum on the IRA side?
No, for TSS, it costs $1,500 plus whatever the cost of LLC, so like $1,800 or whatever the LLC costs or whatever the corporation costs, you know. So, and I would like to say this, Quincy and those guys, they're all good guys, and I like them. I'm not bad-mouthing them. I really wish we wouldn't even say their names, because I'm not here to bash any.
Right. No. But
you know what I'm saying?
This is family. Yeah. We are family, so you can talk.
I mean, I'm going to be speaking at the Quest event on raising private money in February, you know? So, and I've told them that I'm involved in this company, that they may not want me to speak, and they said, as long as you don't promote that while you're at my place, you know, we still need your expertise in these other areas. So I've been above board with them, you know.
Yeah.
I just want to make clear, because somewhere this recording will get out somewhere. I just want to make clear, I don't dislike anybody, but there's more than one way to do things, and I have another way, and I'm out there trying to get some business, you know.
Yeah, true. That's true. Okay. All right. Perfect. Thank you so much. That was my main question.
And click on the little micro link to get a free consult, and Jack Jean will probably call you, and you know, they'll figure out what you're trying to do, and they'll get you over to Tim as soon as you're ready, you know?
Okay. Yes, perfect. And we'll talk more in detail when I see you on the 26th in San Antonio.
Okay, sounds good. You're going to be there, huh?
Yes, I will be there. Not on the Quest one. I'll be on with the John Jackson one.
Yeah, John Jackson. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I haven't spoken a long time, so I'm going to be a little rusty, but that might be fun.
Are you planning to come the same day or like a couple of days before and play the golf?
I don't know. He's going to let me know, but it just depends on what I got going on, you know. But I did agree to speak. I guess it's on Saturday at.
Saturday, yeah.
2 or something, I don't know.
Right. All right, perfect. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks, Rick. All right, press star 2 to raise your hand. I have no hands up right now. If we're done for the night, let's see how long we've been on this call. We've been on the call an hour and 15 minutes about, give or take a couple. So if there's no more questions, we'll call it a day. Mike will be on the call next Tuesday. I'm going to be at a mastermind meeting in Tulum, Mexico. I'm a member of a mastermind called Multipliers, which is a group of very successful, 50 successful businessmen. It'll always be 50. It won't be more than 50. And we not only talk about business, but we talk about how to survive being a successful entrepreneur and all the pressures of normal life that happened to everybody, anything from drugs and alcohol to, I don't know, you name it. It's being discussed there in a very private manner where men can talk to men and try to get through things just besides how to make more money. We do go there to make more money or improve ourselves in the financial department, but we also go there for a much bigger reason as far as I'm concerned, and that's how to navigate this world and finish with all your relations and all your sanity and all your integrity and everything that you would wish that you could finish with. So that's where I'm headed, Tulum, Mexico, Multipliers. All right, I'm out of here. I appreciate you all. It's been a great call. If you know anybody that wants to join this call, why don't you introduce them to me? And, you know, maybe I can give you a little affiliate check or something for introducing them. We could always use some new blood in here. And let's see who we can find. So give me a buzz if you've got someone that might be interested, and we'll talk to them about it. Thank you very much. We're out of here.